You're listening to KX93.5 FM.
FM. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's time for the Friendship Show.
Friendship Show.
With your hosts, Dawn Price, Mark Miller, and Scott Hayes. The Friendship Show.
Friendship Show.
Friendship Show.
Good morning. I just blew Scott Hayes off his story.
Wow.
Sorry about that.
I'm up.
You looked like you were dozing over there. It's 9 o'clock. It's time for the Friendship Show.
Yes.
Wake up. Dawn Price has the morning off. She's not here today. But Scott Hayes is here this morning. Good morning, Mr. Hayes.
Good morning, Mr. Miller. How are you today, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. How goes, furniture shopping?
The ongoing saga. I've recently moved, and so I'm putting together a home. Now, I have to say that I've sort of been waiting for this opportunity for many years. I haven't really put together a home since I've been in California, so I'm probably taking it a little more seriously than I need to. But it's going well. I believe we're moving on to living room furniture at this point.
Nice, nice, nice. And you were showing me some couches the other day.
Yeah.
Have you picked a couch in particular?
I believe I've made a decision, but I'm kind of cheap, so it's hard to pull the trigger.
Gotcha.
But it'll be fine. Until then, pillows on the floor work just great. Did you get a chance? I sent you a link the other day to listen to our interview with a 100,000 Homes campaign last week.
I did, and I actually went to the link and listened to it a second time, and it was a great show, honestly. That was just a great show.
I just think that all of those people, Linda Kaufman from the national office and right. Brunel from Orange County United Way, Chris Coe from Los Angeles, right. Just very smart people who know what they're doing right. And are running a great operation there.
Yeah.
That show is up on the radio station's website. So anyone who wants to learn more about the 100,000 Homes campaign and how 100,000 chronically homeless individuals will be housed by July 2014 can simply go to kx93.5.com.
Click on.
Schedules.
Click on.
The Friendship Show.
Click on.
Podcast.
You know, it's interesting. We had Henry Capone from the islands in, maybe it's been like a month ago or so. I don't really remember. But I chatted with him just a couple of days ago because he was very interested in that campaign as well. Hawaii, as you know, has, a homeless issue there, and they're trying to manage that the best they can. And so he's in the process, he told me, of he's been inspired by that 100,000 home campaign, and he's in the process of writing a song.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he's going to send an MP3, I guess, in the next couple of weeks for us to maybe take a listen to.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We're going to get to preview it?
Well, I hope so.
Really?
I would hope so.
Break it here on the show?
Break it here
on the show. I love that when that happens like that. That's awesome. Is there anything in the hopper? What's coming up?
Yeah, we've got a lot of shows coming up. None that I care to announce necessarily.
Oh, really?
Because you never know if people are going to back out or not. So I hate to commit to somebody and then at the last minute they can't make it.
Anything big?
Well, perhaps.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like, really big?
Well, no. Not bigger than Roger Daltrey. Let me put it that way.
Well, everything is downhill from
there. Well, I guess it's all relative, actually. Maybe it is bigger than Roger Daltrey.
No, I would say everything's downhill from that. Dawn is working on Nuns on the Bus.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
Yeah. And I wish I knew her name. I can't remember it. But this nun who is in charge of Nuns on the Bus is apparently like a national policymaker. She was a speaker at the Democratic National Convention.
She seems huge, really. I mean, she's done TV interviews. I went to that website. I checked them out. It's just a funny name, really. Nuns on a bus, and they travel around, I guess, the country talking about various issues. And the last issue I think they were talking about was immigration. Is everything
really?
Yeah, I think so.
I just, having attended Catholic high school, I'm all about when the nuns are out there.
Really?
You don't want to mess with the nuns.
What was that like, by the way? I'm always curious about those who attended Catholic.
Catholic high school?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I only went for a year.
Oh, okay. Did you ever get your, hand hit with a ruler? Or
no, you
like
know,
that?
I think at that time, there was, I don't know, being a nun was different. I remember being a little kid and going to church and the nuns with their habits and the whole thing and all of that. But I met some really cool nuns. Huh? As a matter of fact, some of my best friends are nuns. Truly.
Have you ever seen Sister Mary Ignatius?
Oh, yeah, I love that show.
Yeah, oh, okay.
All right. This morning.
Yes.
Julie Kraft is a marriage and family therapist with a private practice in the San Diego area. Right. She has written this book. I have it right here. Oopsie. She has written this book, The Mindfulness Workbook for Addiction, a guide to coping with grief, stress, and anger that trigger addictive behaviors. Mm-hmm. And this book has been getting quite a bit of notice.
Right.
It's a wonderful book, and Julie has come up from San Diego to be on the show this morning. So
and we should mention it's a beautiful book, by the way, beautifully designed cover, back front cover, back cover, and it's a workbook as well. So it's not just, you know, a sit down and read. It's actually a workbook where you go through a process.
Yeah, it's very interactive.
Yeah.
So we're going to get some therapy this morning.
Oh, well, I could use it.
It's been a long time coming.
Yeah.
All right, should we take a break?
Sure.
All right, let's take a break, and then we'll be back with Julie Kraft. Welcome back to the Friendship Show here on KX93.5, Laguna's only FM.
You want to give us a call on that song, by the way? That was...
That's Jimmy Cliff.
Jimmy Cliff.
I can see clearly now.
I can see clearly.
I don't think he originally recorded that, right?
No, I don't think
that's just
so.
His version of it.
Yeah, great version of it.
Yeah, I love Jimmy Cliff. Okay, we are joined in the studio this morning by Julie Kraft, co-author of The Mindfulness Workbook for Addiction, a guide to coping with the grief, stress, and anger that trigger addictive behaviors. I'm very fascinated by the book and the concept. So good morning, Julie Kraft.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thanks for coming up from San Diego.
No problem.
All right. Can we start, Julie, by talking about, certainly I work for an organization called Friendship Shelter. Probably 70% of the people that we work with are dealing with some sort of addiction issue and are in different stages of recovering from that. exactly what is addiction and how does it affect people?
Great question. So I think of addiction as really any behavior beyond drugs and alcohol, any behavior that has serious consequences for us, and yet we continue to do the behavior over and over again compulsively. And of course, over time, this behavior increases in frequency, increases in amount, and we find that no matter what, we can't seem to stop.
And when does that become an issue? Like when does it come from being sort of like an annoying behavior to something that is now having a negative impact on your life or becomes dangerous?
It happens slowly and over time. For some people, quickly, but for the most part, these behaviors tend to start off innocently, maybe with some experimentation, and then little by little become more and more compulsive. So I really think what usually drives people into treatment is the more severe consequences. So loss of a job, loss of family members, loss of a marriage, for example, loss of all your money, that kind of thing is usually what it takes before these issues are addressed, because it is so very hard to stop.
Is this primarily what you deal with in your private practice, is addiction, or do you counsel and...
You know, I see a range of clients with different issues in my private practice, but I also do some work at Sharp Mesa Vista Hospital down in San Diego, and that's primarily with dual diagnosis outpatients. So most of my patients there have just come out of detox, and they're dealing with not only drug and alcohol addiction, but also anxiety, depression, bipolar.
And it's hard to tell which one is fueling which at that
exactly,
point, right?
Absolutely. It's really hard to tell what comes first.
Yeah. Do you think, is there a rising occurrence of addiction in our society?
I do think so. Yes, absolutely. And I think that we're seeing a broader range of addictions on the spectrum now. So again, beyond drugs and alcohol, we're seeing a lot of pornography addiction, other internet addictions, including internet gambling, and then gambling addiction itself here in California is really severe and on the rise.
Is it really?
Absolutely. California itself has now free treatment for gambling addicts because it is so severe here. So 1-800-GAMBLER offers a series of sessions for free for those who are struggling with that. Yeah.
When does it go from being just a curiosity or a passion or an interest and become actually an addiction? Is there a fine line there, or is it just boom, all of a sudden there are signs that indicate you're addicted to something?
It's a great question, and I'll tell you, if I knew where that fine line was, I would be a billionaire,
right?
Because then you could drink and use and do whatever you wanted to do right up to that line and then stop, right? But we don't know where that line is. We don't know. Usually when people realize that there is a problem, they have far crossed that line. There's been changes to the brain that that make it absolutely nearly impossible to stop. Not impossible. There is hope.
And so if I were, say, just going to the casinos to gamble a little bit, it's not really a problem necessarily. But certainly I'm developing, if it turns into addiction, I'm developing some sort of patterns.
Yes.
That would and is there an ability to recognize those patterns early on?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, my first thought when you said that was, is your wife mad at you that you're going to the casino?
Got you.
So are you coming home from the casino to chaos in the home? Are you finding that you skip a day of work to go to the casino or take off early to go to the casino? What other things in your life, other things that we in general value in our lives, are falling by the wayside because of the gambling itself, right? So it's no longer fun, simple. Something says, I got to go do this. It's more important than the things that used to be really, really important to me.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about our society as a whole that leads to a rise in addictive behaviors?
You know, what comes to mind for me is now. It's in our culture, we do expect things kind of on demand. And this is increasing very much with things like the internet, right? How long does it take before I press the button again, right? If it doesn't come up right away, I want it now. So I think this is definitely, on the rise. And there is this sensation that, you know, something like drugs and alcohol change our feelings. They change our emotional state very, very quickly, right? So if I'm feeling anxious, right, I can go to therapy, and I can be in therapy for, let's say, a couple of months, and I'm going to work on my anxiety, I'm going to learn new skills, and it's going to be great. I might go to the psychiatrist, and he might give me a medication that works not fast-acting but long-term, and it might take a couple of weeks to kick in. If I go to the bartender, he's going to say, here's a shot, you're going to feel better in 2 minutes. And that's, you know, that's the way our society rolls with this.
I do have to say that the other day I was trying to download something or upload something from my computer, and it was taking perhaps a total of 4 minutes.
Yes.
And I was furious
that
it was taking so long to upload this thing. And then I stopped and I realized, Mark, you know, 10 years ago, this would have taken 4 weeks to accomplish.
Yes.
And
yes.
You can't wait 4 minutes. To get it done.
Absolutely.
I get that.
Yeah, and that's called frustration tolerance, right? What's our ability to tolerate frustration? And in your case, in that situation, it was low, right? And frustration tolerance, I think, is a big piece of this. We have a less and less ability to just kind of tolerate difficult feeling states, whatever those might be, boredom, restlessness, anger, fear, whatever it is. And there's this desire to quickly shift to a different feeling state, one that we might be more comfortable with. And
I mean, isn't that, to a certain extent, what we're all doing all the time is trying to manage our feelings about things?
Yes.
And it's just a matter of how adept we are at doing it.
Right. Absolutely. And there's management and there's tolerance, right? So management implies that I'm working on, addressing the feelings. Something like tolerance or acceptance, which we talk a lot about in the book, is this, you know, state of just accepting, allowing a feeling to be what it is, even if it's uncomfortable, just noticing and allowing for it. And that's where mindfulness really comes in.
And not put a value on it, not put a judgment on
it.
Right.
It doesn't have to be good or bad. Just this is what it is, right? You hear that a lot in recovery. It is what it is. It is what it is. And that's that acceptance piece.
I'd like to, later on when we get into the book, we're going to talk specifically about feelings. And I have one question for sure that I want to ask you about feelings, because it's something I go around saying, and I don't even know if it's true.
Okay.
So we'll check that out. Is there treatment for addiction? Because addiction therapy treatment is a multi-billion-dollar industry in America.
Absolutely.
Does it work?
Treatment does work. The statistics are still not great. However, for those who want to get better and are motivated to get better, there is treatment available. There's wonderful treatment available. But this is an incredible lifestyle change. I mean, treatment genuinely... again, if we go and try for that quick fix, it's not going to work out. It takes time. It takes the slow progress to getting back into a life that does not include these substances or behaviors. So it is. It's slow and it's steady. And it also requires, again, a lot of sacrifice. So it may very well include changing people, places, and things. So not going back to your old watering hole where all the guys are. Not going back to the same parties. Maybe not having that, every year we have the Christmas party and it's the first year of recovery. Maybe you don't. It's taking it so seriously and realizing that a genuine change of lifestyle is needed for recovery to take hold.
So it's a long-term process.
Absolutely.
It's not something where you do something for 30 days and now the problem is gone.
I don't believe so. I believe, that might be true in some cases, but I often tell my clients and patients who are new in recovery, it's possible that you can stay sober without going to meetings. It's possible you can stay sober, not doing X, Y, and Z that's recommended. However, if I had a deadly disease, like, let's say, a terrible brain tumor, right, and I went to the doctor and he said, it's possible it'll be fine, but here's what I recommend, I would probably do what he recommended, right?
This is oftentimes what we tell people in our program who are reluctant to, say, attend some sort of meeting or 12-step program. Mm-hmm. Just go 30 or 40 times.
Right.
And then at the end of that, let's get together and let's talk about if there was anything useful or helpful that came out of it. If there wasn't, let's do something different.
Right.
If there was, let's go to 30 more.
Great. That's fantastic.
You know, these addictions, by the way, this could be, we're not just talking drugs and alcohol, as you mentioned. These could be addictions to Diet Coke. These could be addictions to food. These could be addictions to sex. These could be addictions to all sorts of things,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
whatever the addiction is the process, the recovery pretty much the same, or does it depend on what the addiction is and then your recovery process is different because of the substance?
Yeah, I think it's both. Okay. I think it's both. I think for the most part, recovery from addiction is very much the same. So there is a process that unfolds, and the, you know, addiction treatments available will be effective for any of these behaviors. But then, of course, there are, you know, some differences. So whereas you might, you know, abstain completely from alcohol and drugs, absolutely, you can't abstain from food. Although there is, you know, the model of abstaining from specific foods, sugar, wheat, or whatever it is. But for the most part, yeah, I do think that the treatments are the same. Yeah.
And I was under the impression there are triggers in addiction, that there's something, and I don't really quite ever grasp that concept. What does that mean exactly? There's a trigger.
Yeah. Well, it kind of brings us back to Pavlov's dogs, if you're familiar with that, with Pavlov's dogs. So these dogs that would salivate when they were provided meat powder, which makes sense, right? You see the meat powder and the dog immediately, you know, smells it and starts to salivate. But then they started to notice that the dogs would salivate when they saw the doctor who provided the meat powder. So there's no reason to be drooling, but they are anyway. So they made this connection, right? They discovered this this behavior that when they saw the doctor, they were triggered to drool, right? And the same thing happens for people in recovery, right? If they, let's say you always use drugs with your friend Bob, right? Whenever you saw Bob, there was drugs there, you were using drugs. So you see Bob now on the street, or you try to hang out with Bob and just have a cup of coffee, that is a trigger for you now because there's an association that's been built between Bob and drugs, right? Bob and your using of drugs. So it's right there in the brain, just hardwired. See Bob and remember the feeling of using drugs. Right. So those triggers can be broken over time, but they do take time.
Yeah, that's interesting to me, you know, that everybody has a trigger that kind of makes that happen in them somehow, some way, and that that can be broken over time. But I guess the first initial thing is to sort of recognize there's a problem.
Yes.
And then kind of figure out where that trigger is.
Yes, absolutely. So that should be an initial component of treatment. Whatever kind of treatment you're doing, figure out where those triggers are, what they are.
No matter what the addiction is.
Right, exactly. Figure out those triggers for yourself, what's specific to you that's going to be triggering, and then you develop a plan around it, how to deal with
those. And this sort of raises your consciousness about the idea that, oh, here's that trigger coming at me again, and at least I'm aware of it.
Yes. Right, so I'm not just crazy, and I don't know why all of a sudden I want to use, and there must be something wrong with me. It makes absolute sense. Ah, there was my trigger. There it is. There's a pattern to this, and I know how to deal with it right, over time.
Wow. Yeah.
I believe in your book, Julie, what you're saying is that awareness is mindfulness.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Bringing mindfulness and awareness is absolutely key in the treatment. Yeah.
And this concept of mindfulness, is this something that's new to the treatment of addiction? Is this a different perspective?
You know, I'm not sure. I wish I could kind of quote you exactly when mindfulness came into the treatment of addiction in that picture. I'm not exactly sure when that started, but I do know it's been a couple of decades now since mindfulness came into the psychotherapy world, much more so with the development by Marsha Linehan of dialectical behavioral therapy, which is the primary treatment for borderline personality disorder. And they found that mindfulness itself, these mindfulness skills, were incredibly helpful for people with borderline personality disorder, which is characterized by strong emotions, interpersonal difficulties, you know, difficulty managing and handling emotions, difficulty handling relationships, this general sense of instability and lack of identity. Now, everything I'm describing here, you could probably attribute to someone new in recovery, right? Someone who's fresh off of an addiction, right? Is these mood swings, interpersonal problems, all of this. So mindfulness for a long time has been used for these kinds of behaviors and mood states,
Can you define for me mindfulness?
Sure.
I'm not sure. I mean, I know the word,
right?
But I know how it's applicable here.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yes, mindfulness has become kind of a buzzword, but just to clarify, so mindfulness is about full attention to the present moment experience. So full attention, and in the present moment, I might be having thoughts about the past. So, but in that present moment, I'm really attuned and paying full attention to those thoughts as they rise up. So noticing, what are my thoughts? Noticing, what are my feelings? and noticing the world around me. So I can be mindful to my internal states, so thoughts and feelings, and I can also be mindful to the world around me. So I can take a mindful walk in the park, for example, and just be really tuned in to the colors, the scents, the sounds, the way that the sky looks. So just really bringing my full attention to that experience, and also with non-judgmental attitude. So I'm not going to judge, this is good, this is bad. It's a noticing, it's an awareness.
That's my external environment.
Right.
Now, my internal environment, mm-hmm. there's a mindfulness process as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we'll hopefully get a chance to maybe do an exercise later that will tune us into our internal state, so our mind. So we'll be really noticing what our mind is up to, what our thoughts are doing. So often people will describe, you know, my thoughts just race all the time and it makes it hard to sleep and other things. So this kind of slows down that process where we really just kind of notice what the mind is up to in this gentle way. Again, non-judgmentally, yeah.
And this is a skill that people can learn?
Absolutely. And you know what I like to tell my clients, actually, who are a little bit intimidated by this when we first hear about it, is I really do believe that all of us have a sense of being mindful without noticing it. So when I ask my clients, is there anything that you do that you're just totally there when you're doing it and your mind isn't distracting you and you're just really present, yeah. right? And people have that. People will talk about, when I'm writing a song, you know, I'm just really in it. Nothing is on my mind. I had a client the other day say, you know, when I do a puzzle, I'm so focused on the colors and the edge, you know, and where it will fit that I'm just really tuned in right there. And for me, it's boogie boarding. For some reason, this is like my most mindful experience, just being so much the cold water, the waves, like I am just there, right? Yeah. And it gets me, you know, just completely in the moment that I'm in. And I just love that.
This idea of mindfulness, to me, it seems sort of meditative, mm-hmm. if that's even a word.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that seems sort of Eastern.
Uh-huh.
It seems sort of Buddha, Zen-y kind
of to me. Absolutely.
Is this an Eastern philosophy?
It absolutely is. Yeah, this is a Buddhist philosophy. And
this is straight up Buddhism.
It is, yeah.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, it's been around a very, very, very long time.
But, know? I mean, this mindfulness, this sort of being in the moment concept of mm-hmm. boogie boarding, or for me, maybe it's the radio show, or for me, maybe it's teaching or whatever it is, mm-hmm. that's a good thing.
It's a great thing.
Yeah.
It's a great thing. Absolutely. I think the way that our minds are constantly going and just the chatter of the mind, to be able to slow that down and just be where we are, I think just brings a lot of joy and a lot of peacefulness to that moment.
And then if I have a trick, this is a weird question, so
sure.
bear with
yeah.
me, but if I have a trigger moment that's leading me toward my addiction, mm-hmm. let's say, mm-hmm. I have a trigger that leads me for reaching for my first beer or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
how does that mindfulness process come into play right at that moment?
Yeah, that's a great question. So just alone being mindful of that trigger, mm-hmm. so watching, I would want to watch the sensations in the body.
I
maybe I feel itchiness, maybe all around, maybe my chest is tightening up and, right. and you know, I'm just watching and very mindful of these inner cues, what's happening inside my body. And then I might be watching my thoughts going, gotta get it right now, it's no big deal, I can just do it one more time, whatever those lies are that
right.
the disease
those
likes
lies.
To tell, yeah.
That's good.
And being really aware of those.
And that's a good first step.
It is a good first step, that awareness, because it breaks that connection between, you know, feeling and action. Right?
Yeah.
So my sister refers to this as the pausing place, which I love. This idea of just creating a pausing place before a behavior, right? So if I'm, you know, something triggers me and I'm set, I'm going to call my dealer. If I can find just that pausing place, just that moment, it provides enough space for the recovery thoughts to come in, right?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice.
So now we have, you know, that just that mental shift of, oh, wait, I'm supposed to call my sponsor, you know, or wait, oh, what happened last time? You know, just the recovery mind that we are developing, those thoughts have room to enter.
Would you say that's like a muscle, that it's an exercise that you can train, and the more you practice that, the better you get at it?
Absolutely. That's a great way of putting it. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You need to train and exercise that recovery mind.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great technique. I love that.
Certainly in medicine, alternative sort of Eastern philosophy sorts of modalities have mm-hmm. been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Is this happening in Western psychology and therapy as well, these sort of alternative approaches to dealing with mental health?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm grateful for that the, you know, the Eastern philosophies are coming in more and more. There's so much wisdom there for how to deal. I mean, you know, the Buddhist philosophies are about, you know, human suffering, right? And what else do we do in therapy but deal with human suffering and try to help clients to cope with that better? So let's use the, you know, the wisdom of the ages here and get that into the mix. Yeah.
Okay. Your book is full of all kinds of examples and exercises.
Yes.
So maybe we could take a brief moment here. And could you walk us through an exercise that would perhaps help Scott and I become more mindful?
Sure. Okay. So yeah, no, I'd love to do this. So this will be just a few minutes. And for listeners, it's a good idea whenever we do a mindfulness or meditation practice to sit in a chair. You can recline a bit, but people do tend to fall asleep. So it's helpful actually to stay awake during your mindfulness practice. Feet planted on the floor, and you'll actually put your hands just resting on your thighs.
Mark, you're going to play along. Get in the chair.
I'm afraid I'll fall asleep.
Okay, fair enough.
I can do
enough.
It standing, right?
I'll do
so,
it.
And
okay.
Also, if anyone is listening in the car, please don't be driving during this. I don't want any accidents on my head.
Yeah. Good tip.
Okay, so the first thing to start with is always the breath. So mindfulness of our breathing is a great way to start learning mindfulness. Just really being aware of the breath moving in and out of the body. And as you do this, you're going to want to think about that air kind of oozing into the body. These very slow breaths. And feeling the sensations of the air exhaling from your body. Thinking about that breath being slow and low into the belly. When we breathe in slowly and expand our lungs all the way, it expands the belly. The belly tends to rise and fall. This is belly breathing, and it's very effective for the management of anxiety and relieving stress. So getting focused on that slow, low breathing, the air oozing in and out, is an important place to start. And as we do this exercise, I do recommend keeping the eyes closed. But if for any reason you're uncomfortable with your eyes closed, go ahead and give a soft gaze to the floor, relaxing the eyes. Now I'd like for you to imagine yourself by a stream. See yourself there. Hear the water moving. Next to you is a pile of leaves. Pick up a leaf and look at it. See its shape, its color, its size. Now place the leaf into the stream and watch it float away. There are no obstacles in the path of your leaf, and it floats away easily. Now for each thought that fills your mind, you will pick up a leaf, place the thought on the leaf, place the leaf in the stream, and allow it to float away. There are enough leaves in the pile for every thought that comes to mind. One by one, watch a thought arise in your mind, place it on the leaf, and allow it to float away. It is possible that your mind will try to take you somewhere else, far away from your stream. And that's natural. Your mind is very busy. It wants to take your attention somewhere else. But this is your time to be peaceful, to be gently mindful of each thought as it arises, and to let go. I would recommend taking just a few minutes a day to allow your thoughts to float away in this way and become more mindful.
You know, I was sitting here doing that, and first and foremost, I noticed that my body relaxed.
Mm.
Then my mind sort of, it wasn't so scattered necessarily.
It
sort of, and then the idea of the leaf representing one of those thoughts and floating away from me was really compelling for me.
Mm.
Am I supposed to take those negative thoughts that I have and apply them to the leaf and let that leaf float away?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I would say even the positive thoughts, even the confused thoughts, any of the thoughts, just kind of allowing them in this peaceful way of occurring one at a time. Right? Yeah. So I did have a client, I'll tell you, at one point tell me that she grabbed her pile of leaves and just chucked them into the street. She's like, there's too many, so I just, which is understandable. But yes, this kind of gentle one at a time.
And by the way, you have a very soothing sort of voice about you that makes that really nice.
Oh, I put some patients to sleep.
But in a good way, in a good way.
We're talking with Julie Kraft, co-author of the Mindfulness Workbook for Addiction. We're going to take a break, and then when we get back, Julie, we're going to jump into this book and talk about the concepts that are there.
Great.
Regrets collect like old friends, here to relive your darkest moments. I can see no eye, I can see no